It's the second week of summer as of today. Who would have thought in late winter of 2020 that we would still be talking about COVID-19 cases and issues more than 2 years later? That's where we are, though. The counties of our region continue to move back and forth between medium and high risk of COVID spread of late, with Shasta and Trinity counties in the low category, the exceptions. We have our weekly meeting with Dr. Leona O'Keefe, Medical Director at Jackson County Health and Human Services. She joins us weekly for COVID Q&A. Dr. O'Keefe, welcome back.
Good morning.
I learned my lesson, I guess, with this week, not to assume that we'll come down from high risk to medium and stay there. What numbers got Jackson County back into high risk?
Yeah, well, so recall that there are three different numbers that they look at. One is the number of reported cases in the community, and that number never drops below the threshold of 200 per 100,000 people in the population. So that number has remained above that cutoff. So the numbers that are fluctuating are the hospitalization numbers, how many people have been hospitalized with COVID in the last week, and how many people, or excuse me, how many of the hospital beds are being used by people with a diagnosis of COVID. So it's those hospitalization numbers that have gone up and have landed us in that high-risk category again.
Have they gone up sharply or just up enough to pass a threshold?
No, it's been a really gradual increase over the last several weeks. So even though our overall case rates in the community have actually been dropping very slightly, hospitalization rates just have continued to climb overall. So right now we have about as many hospitalized people as we did in between the Delta and Omicron waves. So certainly nothing dramatic, but that number does continue to rise.
The national map, as I was looking at it, appears to fluctuate quite a bit of late. Are things just a bit more volatile in general at the moment than they had been?
I think so. You know, that number for number of cases in the community we know is really unreliable as fewer people test, and those who do test are more often testing at home, and those results don't get reported into the system. So that number is quite volatile and unreliable. And then the hospitalization rates just aren't as closely linked to case rates as they used to be. And we are grateful for that. That's an indication of the effectiveness of immunity, mostly from vaccines, we're learning, and also to the outpatient therapeutics that we have available now.
To the point that you raised a couple of weeks ago that almost knocked me out of my chair when you said that the R-naught value for the current strain around is 12, which indicates that every person infected is likely or possibly likely to infect 12 other people. Is that still the case, or has that also fluctuated?
Yeah, so the latest I've heard is the R-naught is between 10 and 12. So one infected individual can infect 10 to 12 other people. I have not heard that be updated. That was for Omicron. What we've been seeing is that each of the subvariants has been slightly more transmissible. So I wouldn't expect that number to be any lower at this point than that 10 to 12 value.
This slightly more transmissible than Omicron. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Let's see if I can pronounce this. Joa in Talent asks, is it true that the most immunity comes after being fully vaccinated and getting the disease? Question one. The other one is, and when can we get the new Moderna Omicron booster?
Yeah. So help me remember both questions. But the first one about whether the highest level of protection comes after both being vaccinated and infected does still appear to be true. We continue to have more studies done. I think that's one of the challenges. As each new variant comes out, we kind of have to repeat all of these studies to find out if the findings are still true. And that finding has remained true. So you have the least protection if you've never been infected or vaccinated, followed by some protection after infection, although that seems to be weaker after Omicron, unfortunately, than prior variants. And then you get pretty good protection after being fully vaccinated. And then if you've been vaccinated and infected, you have an incredible level of protection. In terms of the new combined booster being available, so the FDA's committee is actually meeting today to discuss what we might expect to see in the fall in terms of boosters. So I think we'll have more information after their meeting today.
All right, so not yet is the point. Probably not in the summertime.
Yes. No, okay. I don't think it'll come in the summertime. We need people to review the data. First, they have to release the data, then it has to be reviewed, and then you still have to make all of those vaccines.
Okay, so back to what you were talking about as an incredible level of protection. I mean, is it incredible enough that people can basically won't get it in any recognizable form?
Okay, great point. So what are we talking about efficacy against? Is it efficacy against an infection or against severe disease? And while infection plus vaccination brings the highest level of protection against both infection and severe disease, it's really the protection against severe disease that's incredible. And in fact, a study that just came out from Qatar showed 100% protection against severe disease. Still, that level of protection against just getting infected in the first place drops down more into like the 70-80% range.
Okay. So it occurs to me to ask then, because it's kind of thing we haven't thought about since the heart of the pandemic, but the idea that there are people who can have it, can be infected, but be asymptomatic completely.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is definitely a possibility. And that's true for all of those categories we just mentioned. You can have an asymptomatic infection, even if it's your very first infection, even if you've been completely vaccinated. So that is possible. And, you know, the majority of people do end up with mild infections. And the people who are at highest risk of a severe infection, severe disease, are unvaccinated and have underlying risk factors.
Dr. Leona O'Keefe, our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange, the medical director at Jackson County Health and Human Services, joining us for our weekly COVID Q&A. You are welcome to supply a Q of your own and get an A from the doctor. 800-838-3760 by phone. 800-838-3760. And our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. A big release from Jackson County Health last week about COVID vaccines and pediatric doses, 6 months to 5 years. Talk about what the county is boosting here.
Yeah, so we now have vaccines available for our littlest ones down to age 6 months, which is really exciting. There are definitely parents and caretakers who have been waiting for this a long time, and this is going to give them that sigh of relief to feel like they can kind of more safely fully re-enter life again. So the Pfizer vaccine is for 6 months to 4 years old, and it's three doses. The Moderna vaccine is for 6 months to 5 year old, and it consists of two doses. So you can get faster coverage through the Moderna because it's just two doses, 4 weeks apart. I will also note that with Moderna, if you have a child who is immunocompromised, Moderna is already authorized for a third dose for immunocompromised children to receive as well.
Why the difference between the cutoff in the upper age, the 4 years for Pfizer and the 5 years for Moderna?
That's just the age groups that they did. So Pfizer did 5 years to 11-year-old for the dose that's already been available for several months, whereas Moderna chose 6 years old to be that cutoff.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because the other information that the county provides is about the dose size, and I hadn't seen it this specifically before, but the Pfizer is 3 micrograms or a tenth of the Pfizer adult dose, where the Moderna is 25 micrograms or a quarter of the Moderna adult dose. So it's interesting that while there are similar constitutions or constructions to these two vaccines, the ways in which they administered are very different.
Yeah, and so I think that brings up why Pfizer is needing three doses and Moderna only two. So Pfizer is a smaller dose of the mRNA, and so you need more doses to get to that same level of protection. And so that's one thing to keep in mind. The other thing, though, is that if it's a smaller dose, the child may have fewer side effects. And so depending on what a parent's preference is for their child, it is kind of nice that you have those two choices available to you, and you can allow your own personal comfort level to kind of guide which one you go with.
Are you concerned at all about people getting a first dose of either of these and then wandering off and not coming back within the period to get the second because they go on vacation or something, which then also turns this around to a question about what recommendations, if any, do you have about getting these relative to going on an out-of-town vacation?
Right. So a really important point about both of them, but particularly Pfizer, you really have to follow through with all of the doses to get protection. Pfizer in particular, we saw after two doses, does not have much protection. So you really need to follow through with that three dose to be confident that your child now has the protection that you're seeking through the vaccine. In terms of delayed doses, vaccines are actually interesting across the board. If you get a dose too early, you risk a lower level of protection. But if you get a dose too late, that risk isn't there. Your body still is able to mount that protection. And in fact, there is a little bit of leeway even with these, the COVID-19 vaccines for these little ones to delay a little bit. So if you know you're going to go on a vacation and you can't or don't want to delay it, I wouldn't delay getting that first or second dose for your child. Go ahead and start the series. And if the next dose is a week or two late, that's okay.
Okay, I'm looking at the side effects, because you mentioned those two, that the side effects for the COVID vaccines for children 6 to 23 months old, irritability and drowsiness. Not often easy to get a clear read on a child this young. And so, honestly, I wonder how you could tell the difference between this and normal irritability and drowsiness.
Well, I suppose we all know our own children and their usual level of irritability. If that changes, then you know it's probably from the vaccine if they just got the vaccine in the last couple of days. But right. I think the point is that the side effects really are nothing out of the usual for vaccines, right? These are very common side effects after most of the vaccines that we give. And in the studies, there were no red flags for safety at all. And fortunately, we've seen these vaccines be used in everybody else, in millions of people around the world, and we've seen that they really are quite safe.
All right. And I see that for children 2 to 5 years, some pain at the injection site. I can report that myself from several COVID shots. Low fever and fatigue. How high is a low fever?
Low fever is usually considered like between 100.4 and 102. Mm-hmm. If you're getting into that 103, 104 range, that's usually when we say, go ahead and give a call to your medical provider just to check in.
Okay. And no myocarditis cases reported in the clinical trials for either of the vaccines.
Yeah. And, something to keep in mind there is that these trials were not large enough to pick up on myocarditis because it is so rare. If we were going to pick up on myocarditis, we wouldn't expect that to happen until far greater numbers of children have received the vaccine. However, the myocarditis rates really are only being increased, as far as we see, in young adults, so teenagers and people in their 20s, and in particular, it's men. And that seems to be related to hormone levels. So there are ways to decrease that risk. You can spread out the doses farther, and that actually helps to decrease the risk of inflammation. But in even the 5 to 11-year-olds, we have not seen an increase in myocarditis in that age group, and so we're not expecting to see it in these very little ones either. And I think the other thing to keep in mind is we're comparing what are the risks of the vaccine compared to the risk of disease itself, because as we've discussed, this disease spreads quite easily. So if you choose not to get vaccinated, you're pretty likely to get infected at some point. And the risk of heart inflammation and really there's a lot of other heart problems after a COVID-19 infection are far, far higher than any risk from the vaccine itself.
An email here from Carrie. Carrie wants to know, is there improved resistance if you're vaccinated by a combination of vaccines like Pfizer and Moderna?
Yeah, there was one study that suggested perhaps there is, but there were some issues with the study. And so possibly, there's no firm evidence to kind of guide us either way. Really what you want to do is in that primary series, so your first couple of doses, you want to stay with one brand or one manufacturer. And then for your boosters, if you want to switch it up, you certainly can. It's safe.
All right. It seems like when you talk about studies that it must be really hard to keep up with all of this. And I can just imagine you and a lot of other public health medical directors trying to scan all the available literature in a real hurry to figure out what's good, what's not, how big was the study, that kind of thing.
Yes, I do a lot of reading and taking notes. So I have a few sources that, you know, send me emails and podcasts so that I can stay up to date on what the latest studies are and try to share that with people like you.
Oh, yeah. I have to get back to This Week in Virology. I hadn't checked out the TWIV site in a while to see what the latest topics are.
That is one of my sources, yes.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Jim Shames, too, before you. This is Leona O'Keefe's moment on the Jefferson Exchange. We join her on Tuesday to get answers to questions about COVID, and there's still time for you to get yours in at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Connie in Eugene. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, good morning. I have a question now that we're entering into summer and everything, and we have so many situations in which there will be open food situations, you know, not like a standard buffet with protection, but just open food everywhere, people clustering around the food, multiple people handling the tongs, et cetera, and nobody wearing masks, I assume. Is there any safe way, aside from COVID, but the other diseases like the colds and other things that, and bacterial infections, that we can safely have any kind of sort of open potluck-like buffet at this point? I guess we're really concerned. I know different groups are very concerned about how to safely do any kind of picnic or buffet.
Yeah, that is a really good question. I know a lot more people, including myself, having food on open tables now. And so thanks for that question, Connie. Dr. O'Keefe, what do you think?
Yeah, well, you know, I think, of course, we go back to the basics. If it's really hot outside and you're having a potluck out there, watch out for things like mayonnaise and all those good things, you know, because we don't want to end up with food poisoning on top of everything else. And then generally being outdoors really is quite a bit safer than being indoors. So holding those potlucks outside is ideal. The masking outdoors is still recommended when there's a lot of COVID around, if you're in a crowded area with a lot of people outdoors. So, you know, take a look at your own risk factors. And if it makes you feel more comfortable and if you're really high risk and you should be wearing a mask, then if that potluck table is really crowded, then wear a mask when you go up to get your food or wait until everyone else has already gotten their food and hopefully there's still some of the good stuff left over and you can go up when there's not a big crowd there. And I think the other thing is carrying around, you know, hand sanitizer. So after you've touched all those pain handles that everyone else touched, if there's not a place to wash your hands, then go ahead and use that hand sanitizer. And then avoid touching your face and putting your fingers in your mouth. So use the forks and the spoons instead. I think a lot of it comes down to your own risk factors and your own risk level tolerance as well.
To the point about wearing a mask when the spread is high, so, I mean, in Jackson County currently, at least last time I looked, was in high. It does seem to fluctuate, like I said. But in that case, would those be the times to wear masks more frequently?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, we really have to pay attention to what's going on locally. And if you're seeing that there are a lot of reported cases, certainly if we're in that high risk category, if you know a lot of people being diagnosed with COVID, then there's probably a lot of COVID around. And that is going to be an even more important time to consider masking.
A final question in our last few seconds here. Oregon Health Authority closing its vaccination site at the Jackson County Expo June 30th, so 2 days from now. Is that just because it wasn't getting a lot of business? It's end of the fiscal year, too, I know.
Yeah, the contract has come to an end, and they can't stay there any longer. And the level of interest is low enough that we think that the rest of the community can pick up that tab and still take care of people. And so if you're still looking for vaccines, then please do check us out at Jackson County Public Health and we can give you help. You can call us, go to our website, or give a call to 211.
All right. Dr. Leona O'Keefe, Medical Director, Jackson County Health and Human Services, with our weekly COVID Q&A. Thank you again.
Thank you.